Screw it, we're just gonna talk about comics.
Welcome to Screw It, we're just gonna talk about comics. That's comic books, everybody. This is the only podcast in the history of the planet where two people who are brothers talk about a thing they love, and that thing is comic books. I'm one of the two brothers slash hosts slash kind of comedian, Kevin Hines.
And I'm the other one of all those things, and less Will Hines. And less, comma, Will Hines.
And less Will Hines? Mm-hmm. We had more Will Hines on last time. He's very Will Hines.
He's so Will Hines. Too much.
Too much. He's too much Will Hines. We like less Will Hines on this show.
Mm-hmm.
How you doing, Will?
I would say everything's going great. Everything's going great.
All right, great.
Yeah. How about you?
Don't get too personal.
I taught a sketch class today at the University of Southern California, and that was the last class of the semester. And today I gave them The Secret to Comedy.
Oh man! Well, don't do it on the podcast, and then I'll take your class.
Right.
So. I went to a wedding in Key West last weekend, and I didn't go with my wife, and so now I have sunburn on parts of my back because I didn't have anyone to like that I would subject to like checking my hairy back if it's like all covered.
Right, right.
And so I was just sort of on my own, hoping I got it all, and I missed a few spots. That's it.
You should have brought some Dr. Octopus arms.
I wouldn't want to put them through that either. Only my wife should have to
put the arms on you.
Touch my hairy back.
Yeah.
That's it. That's what I'm up to. We are doing another one of our nationally famous Cosmic Rays and Correspondence, where we cover issues of John Byrne's Fantastic Four comic, a run that you and I both love.
Just us.
From when we were kids, it was one of our favorite runs.
Yes.
And so we are revisiting that run. And then we are also answering emails from our listeners. That's the correspondence part, Will.
Oh, now I get it.
And today we are covering two issues.
263 and 264.
Sort of the last two issues. Maybe him marking time while he's waiting for like the Secret Wars to kick. Like he can't really kick off a big plot line because Secret Wars is about to happen. And so he kind of like.
And he,
it feels a little bit like that. We'll talk about when we get to it. They're fine issues, but it feels a little bit like I can't do more than this.
Yes, I agree. They're sort of workmanlike.
Yeah. But still beautifully drawn and everything. Yeah, John Byrne's worst FF issue is just like a very good issue. So it's that. And then it leads into the Secret Wars, which we covered in an earlier podcast, Will.
Yes. Asterisk, people, see earlier issues, smile and Stan.
So people want to go back and listen to those episodes. They should. I think those were pretty good episodes that we did on the Secret Wars. That's what we're going to cover in a little bit. But first, Will, we have to do our world famous segment.
More famous than the nationally famous.
That's right. Loose screws, where we take our jar of loose screws off the workbench, pull a few out and discuss them. And those screws represent anything other than comic books, generally sort of at least somewhat related to comic books, but not comic books. It's a very simple concept.
And do you have any loose screws you want to talk about?
I don't have any loose screws. My jar is empty.
It's very funny when we go through the whole introduction and then you're like, I don't have any.
We are going to appear on a future episode of The Amazing Spider Chat.
Talk?
Spider Talk. How do we call it? Spider Chat. We're going to appear on the future episode of The Amazing Spider Talk.
Do you think that's because you're trying to rhyme man with chat? Like you're looking for a similar vowel sound?
I don't know. I think Amazing Spider Chat's better. I'm gonna get them to change the name of it.
Yeah, they're not that far into their podcast. Maybe they'll change it.
They've only been doing it 10 years. It's time for them to get the name right. We're going to be a guest on that. And they bring us on to discuss all the villains introduced in sort of an era. They've done it once before. They're doing it again. So I'm just like trying to reread all those Spider-Man comics from like the Tom DeFalco era. Most of which I've read, but like it's been forever.
That takes up
all my time. All my free time is now reading Spider-Man comics and reading our comics. And then, once in a while talking to my son.
Who you say exists. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we are. I'm also prepping, reading all those Spider-Man comics for the Amazing Spider Talk, and there's so many. But I did read all of these when we were kids. Like they are every single one. I'm like, oh yeah, I remember this. And that's kind of fun.
Yeah,
reading a comic book from your childhood.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think they're good. I think they hold up really well. But anyway, maybe that's not for this podcast. But I'm enjoying most of them. But I'm also being completist about it and reading the ones even without new villains in them. So. Which is like a waste of time as far as prepping for that podcast. And yeah. As it gets closer, I'm more and more going like, I'm going to have to start skipping some of these. I don't need to read 4 issues about Silvermane. I got to get to somebody else.
Yeah. I'm reading them all, I think. But, you've read so many more comics than me. I need to try to mm-hmm. keep up in some fashion.
But yeah, I mean, I remember these comics. The covers are like burned in my memory, a lot of them.
Oh, yeah.
I like pull out the comic. I'm like, oh yeah, this cover. I remember pulling this out of the box and seeing it frequently and flipping through it. Even like when I would flip through the box, like this is a cover that I would just see over and over and
these
over.
These are like mid-80s Spider-Man comics.
Yeah, our era of comics. Yeah. All these 80s.
There's one where it's a photo cover of like mm-hmm. Spider-Man without his mask on. So there's like some actor, non-famous, just like some sort of photo model, Peter mm-hmm. Parker-ish looking person wearing a Spidey costume. And it's just like a photo and I remember that very distinctly because that was sort of a unique and novel cover from that time.
The spectacular Spider-Man from around that time, 99 and 100 stand out to me. I remember 99 with the Kingpin pushing Spider-Man and Black Cat apart.
Yeah.
And burned into my memory. Issue 100, I think, has like a big 100 on it. And like there's like a gang war happening all around the number.
So it's fun to revisit that. That's kind of your loose screw.
Yeah, I guess that's my loose screw. It's also a plug for a podcast that I don't know when will be out. We haven't recorded it yet. I don't think it'll be released just after that. It'll probably be like weeks after that.
Yeah, we're really ahead of the curve here because this what we're recording now is going to be out in 2 weeks from now.
Yeah, everything we're recording won't be heard until like
this episode.
Some news event's going to be going on. It'll be like, I can't believe they're not talking about the alien ants.
Yeah, we are recording this. This episode will come out May 3rd, mm-hmm. and we are recording it April 24th. And so anything that happens between the 24th and May 3rd, we can't talk about it. If one of us dies or if alien ants invade, that's why we're not talking about it.
If you die before this episode airs, should I still have it released?
Yeah.
Or do you want me to release sort of a memorandum to you first?
No, get this one out. The people need to hear about what we think about FF 263 and 264.
Okay, great. Got it. What's your loose screw, Will?
My loose screw is also a plug. It is the Comedy Bang Bang book, which is sort of like a lot of our listeners have found us because of my appearances on the Comedy Bang Bang podcast. So I think this kind of overlaps with our listeners' interests. Mm-hmm. And basically Scott Aukerman compiled.
Who's been on our podcast a couple of times.
Been on our podcast twice and is a true blue obsessive comics fan and a fun person to talk about comics with. And I'm going to say a fun person to talk with in general. That's not necessarily the popular opinion. I don't know what the opinion is on his talkability, but he's a fun person to just talk with in general. And he's a big comics fan. But yeah, he like edited a thing where he got like a lot of the people who have appeared on Bang Bang a lot have written pieces in their characters. You know, so like Seth Morris is doing something as Bob Duca. That's one of the popular characters on the Comedy Bang Bang mm-hmm. show. Dan Lippert is writing something as Bill Walton. We talked about him a couple episodes ago, I think.
Yeah.
Maybe last episode. I forget. And
sometimes I don't remember what we talk about in the episode or before or after that isn't recorded.
That's right.
I do remember talking about that with you.
Yes. And so I've seen a copy of the book and it's really beautiful. And it's like, Scott really wanted each of the pieces to kind of have their own visually distinct style. So there's a lot of like different sort of like types of pieces. Like some of them are letters that are typewritten, you know? And so there's like graphic art displaying a typewritten letter, and then it'll be like a pamphlet, you know? So it'd be unfolding of the pamphlet. One of mine is I write it as Morpheus. Which we decided we could do because even though I am very much inspired by the proprietary intellectual property Sandman Morpheus is also a god.
Yes. It's a name Neil Gaiman didn't invent.
Right. So it's kind of like I theoretically could be writing as the sleep god Morpheus, who just happens to look like Robert Smith in a black t-shirt.
Is it drawn like you-ish?
No, it's drawn. I didn't really want that. I wanted it like a emo Morpheus.
I didn't know if it was like you, but with like emo hair.
I thought since I'm like not famous, it wouldn't be necessary to make it look like me. You know, it's sort of like, who cares? Mm-hmm. If I were like an actual famous actor, I guess it might make sense to do that. But the drawings are illustrated by Mitch Gerrits, the probably most famous for DC Comics art.
He does a ton of books with Tom King. He did like the Mr. Miracle book that Tom King did. He did Sheriff of Babylon, which I think is really, really great. He did, a bunch of these. He didn't do the Omega Men one. Which one did he? Oh, he did the
Strange Adventures.
Yes, Adam Strange, the Adam Strange one. That's who I'm trying to think of.
Okay,
those are the two most recent ones I think he did with him. But yeah, Brave and the Bold is the one they're working on now. And they're like all 12 issue maxi series, like Black Label, taking a look at these characters. Through kind of like, I don't know, through Tom King's sort of lens. And they're really great and they're beautiful. Oh my goodness, these books are really stunningly drawn. So this artist is great.
Yeah, he is one of those artists where each individual panel is sort of breathtakingly pretty as well as telling the story. That's I don't think that's necessary for a great comics artist, but it does happen to be true for Mitch.
That's too good to draw your section.
Yeah, I know. Scott called me. He's like, hey, you want to do something as Morpheus? I was like, oh, yeah, I'd love to. He's like, I think Mitch Gerrits is going to draw it. I was like, what? Like a real person? Yeah. I'm not going to draw it? And so I had this time where Mitch was like over Twitter sending me the drawings he was doing.
Did you write a comic book script or did you Stan Lee style it or?
Well, it's not a comic. It is like a short story that's illustrated.
Okay.
There was a slight legal concern that if we straight up did a comic, it would be kind of like taking somebody's proprietary thing. Whereas if it's an illustrated story about the god Morpheus and the artist chooses to draw them this way in illustrations, then it's kind of more like kind of public domain-ish.
It might also be within parody domain.
It's also within, we're sort of like, so it's just a short
story. Is it full illustrations, like where it's one of those comics that's got like a full panel, but then it's just text next to it? Or is it like a short story with spot illustrations?
Spot illustrations, but the illustrations are like three quarters of the page, and then the bottom quarter is my text.
It's like a children's book?
Like a children's book, kind of, yeah. So it was really fun just to get to see him do these. Each one is basically like as good as a comic book cover. I don't know, there's like eight or nine Mitch drawings.
That's going to say, how many pages are we talking here?
Yeah, eight or nine.
How much of this book? 90% of this book is Morpheus?
That's what I pitched. I was like, look, I got a lot. I got like a 150-page novella featuring my character.
Mm-hmm.
But Scott edited it down to 8 pages.
Anyway.
I wrote a 150-page novella. Mitch drew 150 drawings. Scott edited it down to 8.
Okay. I mean, it's his decision, I guess.
And it was really exciting and fun to do.
When's that book out?
It is out now. I mean, tomorrow as we're recording it.
But last week as we release.
Yeah, I think it came out April 25th, Tuesday, but it's definitely out by the time this episode comes out. So you can get it on Amazon or probably go to cbbworld.com, and I'm sure there's a place to order it there. And I looked at it, and it's a really beautiful book. Like, I mean, I guess it is to my advantage to sell this book or whatever, but I truly was impressed. When I saw it, I was like, wow, Scott, you could have just like sort of crapped out a kind of anything just with the Comedy Bang Bang name and probably gotten a certain percentage of people who would want to buy it just as a kind of a memento of the show or whatever. But Scott is one of these like comedy nerds who, if he were a fan of the show, he would want it to be like tons of original stuff.
Yeah.
And he also didn't want the pieces to simply be regurgitating things that had happened on the show. So I did two pieces. I did this, and then I did something as another character I did called Stanley Chamberlain, a physical therapist. So for each one of those, Scott's assistant sent me a summary of what has happened in the episodes that I was on, just sort of being like, don't do this, do more, which meant this poor person had to listen to all these Comedy Bang Bang episodes and track what's happened. And in my episodes in particular, because I always come in with almost no idea and just yes and whatever, the summary of them is insane. You know?
But some characters have been on like 30 times. That's also hard just because it's quantity.
Some of them on 30 times, but some of them do kind of have a similar game they play. So you don't actually have to listen to it. You sort of know in general what territory they travel. But for mine, it's like, what happened to mine? It's like, okay, you declared yourself to be the king of Belgium. And then it's like, okay, right. Yeah, right.
And the continuity is important to Scott Aukerman.
I mean, just broad strokes. Like I'm sure somebody with a fine-toothed comb tries to find.
I don't listen to every episode, but I do know often in episodes he will bring up past episodes. Last we talked, you were doing blah, blah, blah. And it's like.
I don't know how he does that. Like there are like, I don't know how many episodes of Comedy Bang Bang. 5,000 episodes. And he seems to have pretty decent recall of all of them. Maybe he reviews them. I don't know. He puts a ton of work into it.
He should do a podcast.
He should do a podcast. Yeah, he should.
Because I'm bad at that stuff.
Oh, yeah, me too. Maybe that's a reason why his is slightly more successful than ours.
That's probably the only reason.
So that's my Loose Screws. This book I read that features a lot of comedy folks. There is a sort of Sandman-esque, which is comic booky, piece with my piece. And it's just a beautiful work. So if you're a fan of the show, or just a fan of a lot of comedians doing funny written bits, I think it's worth getting.
Do you think it's funny standalone if you haven't watched Comedy Bang Bang?
Yes, I do. I think you don't have to have heard the show. You probably need to know that, oh, this is an improvised show where a lot of characters appear and do funny things. But the pieces are standalone.
That's hard and good.
Yeah, it was a lot of work for somebody. I mean, I crapped mine out, but I'm sure some people really worked hard on theirs. I said, if Mitch has drawn it, I don't need to be good.
I mean, that's pretty true. Those, I can't wait to see how it looks.
They're incredible. And one thing, what he did at first was he sent me drawings that were, he had done some sort of just like clip art, like just for the composition of the drawings. He would do like clip art figures being like something like this. Is it, would this portray the action of the first one? And it was just like a random human being clip art photo here, and then instead of Sandman, just like some random clip art of like a rock and roller or something. And I was like, oh, I guess this is what he's gonna do. Seems like a pretty abstract interpretation of what I said, but I was like, I guess it looks good. He's like, this is clip art. I was like, oh yeah, no, I sure, I know the process, I'm a pro. Some of the drawings are insane. One of them, Sandman has to be holding up a flower and the head of Don Knotts is emerging from it. And yeah, he drew that. It makes sense in the context of things.
Good to reference Don Knotts. Young fans, that's the sort of stuff they're looking
for. Gen Z is going to love the Don Knotts reference.
Yeah, yeah.
You know how you and I grew up. We love Phil Silver's references.
That's right. I mean, Don Knotts was before our time. I mean, really?
Don Knotts is great. I don't mind.
He was before our time, right?
Sure. Yeah, yeah. He was in Pleasantville.
That's the Don Knotts you're referencing, not Mayberry. Yeah. Don Knotts.
Mayberry Don Knotts.
Not the amazing Mr.
Limpet.
Limpet?
Or Lippet?
I don't know. Or not the cherry dumpling.
Apple dumpling gang.
I mean, I know a lot about Don Knotts.
Man on the Street with the Steve Allen Show?
I don't know that.
You have to get this book so you catch up on your Don Knotts references. Yeah. It's mostly Knotts references.
A lot in the book?
Not a lot. 9 or 10.
Wow, that seems like a lot.
I don't know. It was really fun to do. Mm-hmm. Should we move on to some Fantastic Four?
Yeah, let's move on to the meat of our podcast. Let's put this, that's not part of an analogy because it's already too confusing, but let's move on to the main part of our podcast.
Put the mason jar back on the workbench. Were you going to say
that's
that?
Right.
Okay.
I was going to say that, but then I said meat and then I was like, I don't know how to connect a mason jar to the meat we're about to eat. So I don't know. The whole thing fell apart in my head.
I like it. Okay, so issue 263 and 264, this is basically a two-issue story that features the Mole Man, and it features a sort of like new villain, right? Somebody who's like a new villain that I don't think we see again, at least not in John Byrne era.
I don't think he's been seen before or after this. And okay. It's sort of just the thing in the Human Torch.
Yeah. We check in on the others a little bit, but
the previous issue had been the trial of Reed Richards, where Reed Richards was put on trial for letting Galactus live, and he was released. I guess he was found innocent. Killing Galactus was considered not a crime.
Saving Galactus.
Yeah, and so now we're kind of going back to Earth.
Yeah. So let's get into it.
Yeah.
So the cover has the thing tearing through flaming wreckage, screaming Johnny.
Mm-hmm.
That's probably referring to the Human Torch.
I mean, his name is Johnny Storm, so it seems likely.
Mm-hmm.
Could be Johnny Unitas.
Yeah, that's another timely reference.
more timely for John Byrne.
So then we cut into the splash page, and it is Reed and Sue in their Westchester home, and Sue is like painting the nursery because she's pregnant.
It's Connecticut.
Oh,
Bellport, Connecticut.
Okay, I guess that's a reference to Westport, I suppose, or just like
I guess
a
so. I don't,
general
I don't know
Connecticut sounding name.
Just a made up name, not, you know, it sounds like it's not a real one that I know of.
It's not real. And we see Franklin on the floor with a paint can. Sue is reaching to paint a wall, and she's knocking a paint can off the ladder. And Reed is stretching his big old arm in to catch her as he's getting ready to leave for work. Work being a superhero in the Manhattan.
Yeah, not helping paint the room. Making his pregnant wife and child do it.
Yeah. Some things are still like the old FF.
Sue knocks over this can of paint. Reed tries to catch it, but he can't. But Sue catches it in a force field. And then like pours that force field's paint back into the can. It's very impressive.
It looks really cool. It's a fun use of her powers.
Yeah. I mean, this is the sort of stuff I think that is really cool. This is not necessarily important to the story, but in the X-Men 2 movie, there's like all these little sequences early on where every character uses their powers kind of like in a tiny way.
Mm-hmm.
Like you see like Wolverine put out a cigar on his arm.
Right.
And Iceman like makes a beer colder.
Yeah.
And there's like little moments like that where it's like it kind of reminds you of everyone's powers before they're like plot important. And I thought that was really cool and really well done by the Bryan Singer, the director, who has never had any controversy connected to his name.
He's 100% great.
And anyway, so something like this is really cool. It's just like a cool way to remind you of Sue's power and, you know, Reed's power. We see him stretching into the room. It's just like, here are their powers.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's the intent here since they're not really important to the story, but it's fun to just make sure they use their powers every issue.
Yeah. And it's just, you know, we're reading a superhero comic, man. We want to see them cool, groovy powers happen. Then Reed does kind of a fun thing. He's getting ready to ride the train, not even to work. It's kind of silly, but he's going to ride the train partway.
Yeah, he's taking a bus to like a storage locker where he has the Fantastic car parked.
So he's putting on a disguise, and his disguise is just stretching his face so he looks different. That's kind of a fun.
We haven't seen him do that too much or ever, maybe.
He's like not too much stretching. with the face stretching.
He's not like Plastic Man where he like changes into different objects all the time. He's more just like stretches his limbs to flip a switch.
Right. He's more like elongated man in that way.
Mm-hmm.
Plastic Man, it'll be like, I was this newspaper or whatever.
Yeah, right.
It's like, really? So he looks sort of different. He looks kind of older and
He looks like a guy you'd say, hey, you kind of look like Reed Richards.
Yeah.
If you met him.
Yeah. I wonder if John Byrne was thinking about it. I can't make him too. I don't want to bring in a whole master of disguise situation into my comics. I'm just going to make him be able to look a little different.
Yeah.
And then he rides the bus to a storage locker where the Fantastic car is. And he says how there's a visual deflection screen activated so nobody will see him pull out, which I'm like, if that's the case, just keep it at your house.
Yeah. I don't understand why he's
keep it in the backyard, but it's kind of fun.
You think he'd be smart enough to like, I don't know. It seems like a thing they'd have like some sort of elevator to go down 30 floors into their secret underground laboratory underneath their house that shoots out the Fantastic car or something. But
it's sort of fun when John or any comic book, John Byrne, when any comic book has to quote unquote solve kind of like commonplace logistical problems of being a superhero. It's kind of like when at some point they tell you like how, you know, it's like if Superman or Spider-Man has a skylight apartment or something like that. Just like, okay, that's how he gets in and out.
Right. And then with that rule, they can have fun with it. Yeah, like during Dan Slott's era, and I enjoyed Dan Slott's run on Fantastic Four generally, but they moved into like the Thing's brownstone apartment for a while. But they like just installed like some sort of thing that made the insides much bigger than the outsides.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's fine. It's still fun to have them like on a street, like they're on a block somewhere. But it kind of cheats away a lot of the other problems.
That's kind of the balance you want, though. You don't really want to have to deal with too much of this, like, yeah, everyday life logistics. But it is Marvel Comics, and there's a tradition of them being in the real New York City. So mm-hmm. it's kind of fun to see, like, the FF hauling garbage out to the curb or something like that.
Right, exactly.
Okay, so then Reed gets to work, and he is just doing his sort of checking a bunch of gizmos. He checks in on Vision, who is still healing because yeah. of a story that happened in another comic, and I don't care. And then the automatic
Avengers plot.
Yeah. The automatic scanners go off, and Reed turns in shock at, I think, something a scanner is telling him, but we don't see that right now.
It's never told to us in these two issues. It's the Secret Wars thing coming.
Okay.
And the Secret Wars thing is basically like a big Stonehenge metal thing appears in Central Park, and it lures all the heroes and villains in and then takes them to the Beyonder planet. Like, Spider-Man has a few issues where his spider sense just goes off and like goes crazy for a few seconds, and he doesn't know why. And it happens like three times, and it's because of the Secret Wars is coming.
Okay. So that is just setting up Secret Wars, which will happen in between a couple issues from now.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of very annoying that we don't ever even see in this comic them go. It happens in The Thing, I guess.
Okay. Yeah.
Anyway.
That's why the Secret Wars didn't work, and nobody read it, and it wasn't mm-hmm. successful. So we do cut now to our main characters of this issue, Johnny Storm and Ben Grimm. Johnny is racing a car in some exhibition race thing that's happening at not Disneyland, but some sort of equivalent or like competing Disneyland theme park called Wonder World.
Yes.
And it is in California, right? So this is sort of like a non-Disneyland Disneyland. And he's doing the race that I guess is for charity. Ben Grimm is there. I get some moral support. And Ben Grimm is sporting a fun outfit.
Yeah, he's got some short shorts and a polo shirt.
Yeah, it's fun to see Ben just wearing normal clothes.
How did he tuck that in?
Yeah, he tucked the shirt in, which is a funny fashion choice.
I mean, it must be hard with those giant stone fingers is all.
Plus, he's got sandals on, which he doesn't need sandals, right?
No, he certainly does not.
I mean, open-toed sandals and a big rock footer is really funny.
But Johnny's like doing this in disguise. He's like wearing a mask. So he doesn't want the thing talking to him to blow his who he is.
I guess it's a giveaway. Who's that guy the thing's hanging out? Who's that guy that kind of looks like the Human Torch hanging out with the thing?
Yeah. Maybe it's Invisible Woman. So the thing kind of wanders off to like, you know, it's nice a thing to go to support him and watch the race. I'll say that much.
Yeah, these guys squabble a lot, but they're friends.
And then Johnny runs into Julie Angel, the former roommate of Frankie Ray, the current Herald of Galactus, who Johnny has sort of a crush on.
Yeah, and she's wearing a bikini, so she's looking sort of alluring. Mm-hmm. And the excuse is that she is doing some kind of professional appearance.
Like a modeling gig or something.
Some kind of modeling gig at the racetrack. And so she's here. And then she just kisses him.
Yeah. And he mentions that he just got over her, and he's sort of irritated that she kissed him because she was not interested in him.
It's the second girl we've seen just grab Johnny Storm and kiss him in like three issues, right?
Though for John Byrne, that might just be the equivalent of like a peck on the cheek.
Yeah, because we've seen that warm acquaintances will just full-throated just bend each other back and kiss each other as a way of saying hello. So
yeah.
I wonder what John Byrne's life was like. I wonder how he was. What if he just grabbed Chris Claremont and full throated kissed him when he like said hello or something like that.
Yeah, maybe that's what broke those two up. Someone's like, "Hey, he kisses me too much." John Byrne's like, "What? Those casual?
Hey, they're sweet, but it's just too long. Don't dip me back." So then the race happens. Johnny's enjoying racing. Goes into a tunnel. When he comes out of the tunnel, it's implied that something has happened.
His tire like blows and the car flips over and explodes.
Ben is, you know, distraught, screams Johnny, jumps into the wreckage looking for him and can't find him, pulls out a charred body. And then we cut to after this, Ben is being bandaged up And he is suspicious. He
burned his stones.
Yeah, he charred his stones.
Mm-hmm.
So he's suspicious. He smells a rat.
Yeah, he doesn't think Johnny would die in something like that. He thinks Johnny could survive that. He's seen Johnny survive bigger explosions, and I think he's right.
He's absolutely right. Julie Angel walks up, and she's kind of sad, although her life is nuts. She's had her roommate join Galactus. But she's sad to think that Johnny's dead. Ben tells her she doesn't think so and that he's going to go look into it. Right. And I forgot to mention that Julie Angel mentioned she's come out to California with Gray Landers, the acting teacher, who I think something happens with in a couple issues. That's why I bring that up.
Acting teacher or acting student?
Acting teacher or student, but she's come out to work with him in a professional capacity, even though she has a crush on him because he looks just like Christopher Reeve.
Right.
I'm just keeping.
We haven't seen him since his first appearance, but he still exists in the background.
I feel like he shows up in a story. That's why I bring him up. But yeah. Not in this issue, she just mentions him. Anyway, Ben gets in the Fantastic Car and he goes off to investigate. Oh, they mentioned how the whole race is sponsored by a guy named Alden Moss, who is described as he's like a recluse, billionaire, eccentric, Walt Disney-ish person, like a Howard Hughes meets Walt Disney.
Right, right. He's like the guy who did Jurassic Park.
Yeah, some like genius recluse.
Mm-hmm.
And Julie just knows that he lives on a star-shaped island.
Yeah.
And so Ben just kind of sails around until he finds a big star-shaped island.
Yeah, he finds it. And he goes, man, that's probably it.
And it's extremely clearly star-shaped.
Yeah, he goes, it's the only one even slightly star-shaped. And I guess he's like, because the landmass isn't quite star-shaped, but the trees are cut into a very clear, distinct, sharp star.
We find out later in the story that for reasons we'll find out, there's like a lot of Earth has been dispersed around the outskirts of the island. So I think maybe it was supposed to look only vaguely star-shaped. And then in the coloring of it, he made the decision. It's like, I better just make the star shape to make it clear what's happening or something.
Yeah, I don't know. It's also one of these things, like, I don't know, the thing sees this and he's like, I'm not sure this is what they're talking about. It's how anyone would see that island and go, not call it a star-shaped island. I don't know. But so he settles on this island and is greeted by three men in blue suits that turn out to be robots, and they're acting kind of robot-like.
They're kind of smiling corporate drones. They work for Alden Moss. They invite him in to see their boss, and it turns out they're owner/creator. Yes. Ben goes into some kind of huge futuristic looking compound. It kind of looks like a building you might see in a futuristic movie from the 1970s, like Buck Rogers Garage or something like that.
There's these giant like floor to ceiling portraits of like the cartoon characters this guy created.
And then a robot woman it welcomes him and explains the project that is being worked on, which is insane.
Yeah, he is drilling a hole to the center of the planet to like shoot energy into it to make the Earth bigger so there's more room for people.
Yeah, it's like the population booms means we're running out of space. And so if we heat the core, the Earth will expand. We'll have plenty of room for everybody. And it's like a cartoon presentation is explaining to us. It's very Jurassic Park.
Yeah, it's like the DNA character that talks on Jurassic Park.
Yeah. We don't hear what Ben thinks of this plan. He might be fully on board. but then we see Alden's plan for powering his heating of the core is to use the Human Torch Nova flame or whatever.
Right. So he's got him strapped to some sort of Jack Kirby-ish device where he's held over a pit, forced to Nova flame and shoot his flames down this big tunnel. And so the thing says, well, how am I going to get him out of here? And he gets ready to clobber.
But just as he cocks his fist, Alden Moss walks in, stops Ben and wants to talk.
Yeah. And he proves that he's sane because he refers to himself as the Messiah here.
Yes. He says he's the savior of all mankind. That lets us know that he's totally normal and on the level.
Mm-hmm.
Cause that's always people who really have their crap together tell you that. Ben just kind of ignores him and jumps or punches through the wall to get Johnny, but it's just a hologram. And instead, Ben sails into the pit, falling deep into the earth.
Yeah, he falls into, like, I guess what goes to the core of the planet is what we're told.
Supposed to head at least close to the core of the planet, and it Ben's like, it doesn't go that far, but it sure goes far. Because he's Ben Grimm, he survives the fall no problem, but at the bottom he is prodded by a big metal rod held by, Kevin?
Dr. Doom.
Oh,
no, Kevin. Famous underground Fantastic Four villain.
No, this, I'll give you a hint. Blind, mm-hmm. Lives underground.
Yes.
Fought FF in a very early issue.
One more clue.
He went underground because somebody called him ugly.
Okay. Namor the Submariner.
I mean, Namor is a subterranean guy,
mm-hmm.
By virtue of his name. But no, this guy
the
has
a monocle.
No, it's not the monocle. It's not a – it is the Mole Man.
Yes, the Mole Man, the very first villain that FF ever faced.
Yeah, John Byrne is continuing his tour of all the Jack Kirby characters, and now we get to the Mole Man.
Yeah.
I think we saw him before in a John Byrne story.
I feel like we did as well.
Some kind of Doctor Doom thing. I don't remember.
I don't think we did.
Okay. Anyway, we're seeing him now.
Based on just stuff that's mentioned in this story, I don't remember. I don't remember stuff we talk about. We should know things.
I think we should take a break and then do the next issue.
Okay.
Hey, Kevin, we're back.
Cool. Did we talk too much about that last issue?
Probably.
Okay. Let's talk about issue 264.
Okay. So this looks like a totally original drawing that I've never seen before.
Yeah. It is an homage to the very first Fantastic Four cover. At least the monster is in the same pose, and it's the same monster from the first issue, though this time it's just the Thing and the Human Torch attacking it.
Although they are in...
They're in the same position.
Respective positions on the cover.
Yeah. And the Torch is screaming, "The Mole Man's monster, it's attacking again."
And Ben goes, "Torch, wait, this time it's on our side." And so John Byrne is expecting you, the reader, to be familiar with FF number one.
Yeah, and I think that's fair.
It's just like you should know that it's cool that people are going to know who Don Knotts is.
Oh boy. Then we get a splash page close-up, Mole Man's mug. It's really great.
Yeah, really funny picture of Mole Man in clothes. What do you picture his voice being like? Kind of classic villain, right? Like, carry him.
I would expect it gravelly. Yeah, sort of like, just sort of like a little hard. Because, I mean, he doesn't talk a lot, right? So he's probably he's like kind of somebody who needs to clear their throat.
Kind of Gollum-y?
Yeah, maybe a little bit.
Okay.
Are you auditioning?
I'm trying to become the Mole Man. I'm pitching myself to Kevin Feige. No one's asked. I don't think it's being cast, but I'm just saying, hey, if you ever think of it.
Yeah, I think you'd be a great Mole Man.
Thanks. Wait, why?
I mean, I think you're a funny person. You're a good actor.
Okay.
That's all.
What, because I got a room full of diamonds?
No, it's not because of that. I mean, you can relate to the Mole Man.
So,
you Mole make Man all those buildings fall underground sometimes?
Just because people are so cruel to me. So Mole Man is issuing commands to his slaves, carry him carefully, my mindless slaves. Do not harm him as you transport him into the dark, deep, dark bosom of the earth. Mole Man's a classic villain. He speaks very flowery, third person mm-hmm. a lot. I think there's a number of you dare things that he says. He says you dare. That's like a good giveaway that you are a classic villain.
Yeah. I like that. There's also, I do not wish him hurt in any way until the moment when he dies. Like, all right, dude, just kill him. Yeah, they take him into the middle. They sort of recap the Mole Man's plot. And he's last shown up in Fantastic Four Annual 13 that we did not read. Where I guess he was like being good. He had like built a utopia for all ugly people.
yeah. Anybody who just feels like they're outcast from society because they look weird, they could come live underground in the Mole Man city, all uggos. What yeah. if somebody has a beautiful child? They got to send him up to the surface. I'm fascinated by this.
Yeah, but it gets ruined. Like it like blows up and flames shoot in and the whole
I'm
thing.
I'm an LA fire. 5, but I'm a Mole Man utopia 10.
It would solve a lot of villain issues, right? A lot of villains would be very happy there.
Sure. Okay, but then the Alden Mass's experiments have ruined the society, like.
Right. And when Mole Man went to investigate it, he finds the thing there. So he's like, oh, the Fantastic Four did this, which doesn't fully make sense. It's not really their MO to destroy things, but.
Yeah, but I guess if you come upon the thing and they're your enemy, you might just assume something's up. So then we talk to Alden Mass and, or no, Bengrim summarizes what's happening.
He recaps the last plot line. Mole Man doesn't fully believe it. And the thing says, okay, let me try to convince you before you kill me by rolling a rock at me or something, which I don't think would kill him.
Yeah, it's going to just Indiana Jones him by rolling a big boulder onto the thing. But thing says, let me talk to you. We cut back to Manhattan where Reed is flying to investigate the disturbance in Central Park, which of course will lead to him being taken to the Secret Wars.
Right, and it says this will happen in the Thing issue 10, which we're not going to read, but I guess that's where the Fantastic Four minus the Invisible Girl go to the Secret Wars.
We cut to the Invisible Girl, and she's kind of having either morning sickness or some kind of intense
She's having severe pains, it looks like. But her pregnancy, when she says, my pregnancy with Franklin was not normal, she says. And like when she was pregnant with Franklin, she was like sort of in a, she was like just sleeping the whole time.
Yeah. I can't remember what happened with that. Because it says, she's like, oh, my pregnancy with Franklin was anything but normal. It's like, I remember it being kind of normal. I mean, they left her out of the comic for like six
issues. Like they had to have her sleep all the time because like, and not tell her what was going on. Galactus showed up again and like she couldn't know, it would shock her or something.
Okay.
So I don't remember if Reed put her into a trance or if she was just in one. But she like had no idea what was going on for like, I don't know, like 100 issues it felt like.
It also looks like that, you know, Sue has a babysitter and she's maintaining a secret identity. And she and Reed are going by the names of Mrs. Benjamin.
Mm-hmm.
So they're using the Thing's first name as their last name.
Yeah.
And that's Franklin's middle name, right?
So that makes his name Franklin Benjamin Benjamin. I'm kind of impressed that Franklin hasn't blown their secret yet. I don't think my son could keep that up for that long.
Our real name is Hines.
Yeah. Like, he could do it for a little while, but I'd be like, hey, whenever we're at this house, you're going to have to just lie to everyone. I just don't think he could do it.
We cut back to Johnny. He is being tortured by having Nova Flame invoked out of him somehow.
Yeah. And then the Moloids grab the woman who's torturing him and pull her underground, and the Mole Man pops out.
And saves and frees Johnny.
Yeah, he's basically like, the Thing convinced me off panel.
Yeah, and so now Mole Man, Thing, and Johnny, the newly freed Johnny, have to go find Alden Mass and I guess like just beat the crap out of him because that's the Torch and Ben's MO whenever that something's wrong.
Yeah. They get attacked by a bunch of like robot cartoon characters.
Which is really kind of a fun sequence visually.
Yes. They're pleased that they're robots so the Thing and the Human Torch can cause like more mayhem. That's sort of their favorite thing to do. We see a Moloid almost, I think, die.
In
that first panel of the fight.
Oh yeah, he takes one right to the chest.
I think the Moloid's dead, right?
That guy, yeah, he doesn't look like he's doing too good, but we don't see what happens. That's Kurt Busiek, there's a good idea for a new issue. Ryan North, let's follow up on that guy.
Yeah, like his family.
I said Kurt Busiek because Busiek's the kind of guy I think would be like, whatever happened to that Moloid in panel 4, page 10, you know?
But Ryan North has to do it because he's writing the comic now, so hopefully he spends at least 4 or 5 issues on that Moloid's family mourning him.
Hopefully. So then we cut to Alden Mass, who is like upset that the Torch is freed. So he has a thermonuclear device that he's going to explode in place of the Torch.
Yeah, I get, and he's also supposed to be in some sort of like protective chamber that doesn't fully make to keep him alive or something, but he's left it to deal with this issue.
Yeah, his robots are like, wait a minute, you shouldn't be out of your EA chamber, but we don't know what that is right now.
Yeah. The good guys, Mole Man and his friends, come across a wall that is 15 feet thick and they don't know how to get through it. The Thing's like, well, I'll try. But then the Mole Man blows a whistle and he summons the giant monster from the cover and from the first issue to punch a hole in that wall.
who is trained to follow orders. And then they walk through an enormous tunnel on their way to find Alden Mask, who is dying.
Yes.
He's dying, but he wants to pull the switch to launch the nuclear device so that his last act is to ignite the core so that he can die knowing he saved mankind.
But he died before he could do it. Is that what happened?
He died before he could do it. And the robots let us know that that switch wasn't attached to anything anyway.
Yeah. Well, I think they say the thermonuclear device would have been insufficient to fire the core.
Okay, so it was a real device.
It was a real device that just wouldn't have done enough damage, I guess.
Yeah. So the robots, so they we get Ben, Johnny, Moleman and his friends, Ben and Johnny.
Mm-hmm.
We get to Alden Mask, but he's died. The robots are holding his body, kind of Superman holding the Flash style.
Supergirl.
Supergirl style from Crisis cover.
Yeah. And then they like march into the sea with his body.
So, yeah.
And I guess that's the end.
Yeah, this bit of dialogue is funny. So one of the robots says, the thermonuclear device would have been insufficient to fire the core. There was never any danger, sir, even had he succeeded in the activation of it. And Ben goes, then why, for cripe's sake, did you go along with him? And the robots say, to keep him happy and contented, sir, as we were programmed to do. Next panel, they're all just walking into the ocean.
Yeah, and I think it's meant to be a surprise that they're robots.
Yeah.
I don't think it's ever mentioned in like this they went along with it because they're robots. But also it's like they felt like robots the whole time.
We got so many robots in FF, you know, with the Doom bots. We're just ready for anything to be robots. So this is another template of story that I like to call whoops, no bad guy. You know, where it's like the threat kind of wasn't a threat, you know, just like we take the head off the Roman soldier who's kept the city alive for hundreds of years and he's gone. That just finished him.
Yeah. Well, the thing even mentions kind of anticlimactic, ain't it? We won, but nothing would have been much different if we lost.
Yeah, exactly. He calls it out.
I mean, other than they tortured Johnny for a while. So I guess if they lost, they wouldn't have found Johnny would have died, maybe.
Maybe. Johnny would have become, they could have hurt Johnny. Then they just fly in the Fantastic Car away.
Oh, yeah. And Mole Man says, like, I'm glad we got along. Next time we will not be friends. I'm not sure why.
I don't know why. Yeah. He just likes to be, angry.
And then they basically say, go read thing number 10 to figure out what's going on. And then when we come back for the next issue, the Fantastic Four will be returning from the Secret Wars with their big Secret Wars change, their equivalent of Spider-Man's symbiote costume.
Which is?
The She-Hulk.
Yes.
That joins the team and the thing is gone.
Crazy big change. So we'll talk about that next time we do some FF issues.
That's right.
All right. Should we do some mail?
Let's do some correspondence, Will Hines.
So to email us, you can email screwitcomics@gmail.com. You can also tweet at us, screwitcomics, or Instagram at us, screwitcomics.
Yeah. First, we have one from Alan Wincup, who draws some really cool drawings on Instagram. He does a lot of Lord of the Rings drawings, so I really dig it. He writes, Dear Milksops, I've been listening to your podcast since the FF run. I skipped over Spider-Man. Who likes that guy anyway? And I'm listening to yesterday's Zot episode. This is an older email where you finally introduced Brian. But in listening to your intros and backstory, I can't help but wonder if I'm not yet another brother separated at birth or perhaps earlier. I'm approximately the same age as you guys and have read mostly the same books as you. I share most of your opinions and humor. I tear up a movie to deal with lost mothers like Guardians of the Galaxy due to also losing my mother at an early age. And I also have a brother named Brian.
What?
Coincidence? We may never know. Thanks for all the entertainment, lads. I'm really enjoying your show, even if I haven't read Zot myself. I think he might be one of us.
He might be one of us, or it could be a coincidence. I think I know. Coincidence or no, I think I do know. It is a coincidence.
I think he's either you or me.
That could also be true.
I know he's not Brian because Brian doesn't have a brother named Brian.
Right.
We have an email from Corey Mintz that has the very mysterious subject. Is Green Goblin the Hulk? Hi, Milksops. My daughter has started asking me to read her comics. After a dozen reads of Spider-Man number 3 and then more Doc Ock stories, she got interested in issue 14 featuring the mysterious Green Goblin and guest starring the not-yet-Incredible Hulk. whatever Steve Ditko's original intention was for the Goblin's identity, I can tell you that Puddin is genuinely hooked by the mystery of who he is and wants to keep reading to find out. Her theory is that maybe the Green Goblin is the Hulk.
Hey, is that a bad theory?
3.5. Based on what you know in that issue.
That's a great theory. That's a really smart idea.
What a twist.
I'm sure Steve Ditko wouldn't mind. As long as it doesn't make any sense, I'm in favor of it.
It's like, oh, I don't want to fight the Green Goblin. Get him back to a secret identity. Oh, no, he's the Hulk. Okay, get him back to being the Green Goblin. Because it would be equally hard to fight. This is an email from Anthony, and he's referring to some discussion of the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles that we had in a episode of the Zot season. Hello, Brothers Hines. I'm writing in response to your question during Loose Screws about why the turtles are so big. I'm a self-titled Turtles fan, and from my perspectives, it is because there are enough turtles to choose who you are like, but not so many that there's a paralysis of choice.
Hmm.
College Humor did a video about how the turtles are just the four humors. I think the video that truly explains the sensation is from a stand-up comic named Anthony Lopez. The Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle is a title that gets more and more awesome with each word added to it. Teenage, target demographic. Mutant, perfect metaphor for adolescence. Ninja, literally the coolest part of all history. Turtles, mind-blowing choice of an animal. It just works. He tried to find the clip and couldn't find it, it looks like.
I have heard that clip before, I think. And, you know, four Beatles, four Fantastic Four, four elements. Like, there is something about that.
Mm-hmm. The biggest reason I enjoy the Turtles to this day and happily share that joy with my son is that they are not set in stone. Each version is something different, and that means there's literally something for everyone. People argue about which version was best, the Fox version with the hyper ADHD intro song, and everyone's answer is pretty valid. Anywho, allow me to once again suggest reading the IDW run of Turtles in the future. It's very good, or at least the three Batman TMNT crossovers. Just look at the art in those books and try to resist reading them. The Turtles sort of maybe presage, like, I feel like now in more and more superheroes and other popular content are willing to, like, kind of reinvent the characters each version versus, like, keeping it similar each time they, like, do a new cartoon or new show.
Yeah.
The Turtles have always kind of been pretty different each one. And maybe that's just, like, they're less precious about the characters in some way.
Yeah. I think there's something like what I'm just naming right now, the Boba Fett phenomenon, which is like when Boba Fett was first sort of introduced as a toy, he had a cameo in Empire Strikes Back, but a really short, sort of insignificant cameo.
Yeah, he's got a line. He does a couple. He follows Han Solo and gives him to Darth Vader, but he doesn't really fight anybody.
Doesn't stand out much more than many of the others, sort of just like kind
he
of by
looks cool.
He looks cool, but the toy was a sensation. Like with the backpack, with the missile, the name Boba Fett, like just the look and the name, mostly the look, but I'm going to throw the name in here, was like a smash hit toy. Everybody loved their Boba Fett figure, imagining stories. Like he just was kind of a hit visual design wise, even though in the movie, there's not a lot to the character. We don't know that much.
Yeah. And even in Return of the Jedi, he doesn't do that much.
But people were, even the little bit where he just kind of flies a little bit, and actually it's really lame.
Yeah.
Everybody was, I remember like a reaction in the theater, like, oh, like Boba Fett, right?
Yeah.
And so I think sometimes if something looks cool and if it's a cool toy, if it is compelling as a toy, it can work as a franchise. Transformers. Mm-hmm. Is there another one? That's even got more to it because their gimmick is like demonstrable and like something you can do, you know, turning a truck into a robot or whatever.
Yeah. But I mean, like Optimus Prime is a very cool looking robot and some of the transformations are sort of lame, but his is just, it just works. That probably helps a lot having that main one be so cool.
I think that still stays with the theory, which is like.
Yeah. I'm trying to back up your theory.
To support what you're saying. Good. Thank you. Yeah. So I think the turtles, I don't really agree that it's because they can be different every time. I don't think that's a selling point. Like people don't want Spider-Man to be radically different each time. They actually want whatever they consider to be the core of Spider-Man to remain true. There's some wiggle room there, but like Spidey's he's more consistent across iterations than like a lot of heroes.
Yes, but I think
Batman's pretty consistent too. I mean, counting Adam West as a weird outlier.
You're seeing more and more things where, like, the different cartoons for Batman, he'll be like silly in one and serious in one and adult in another one. Like the range from like the Christopher Nolan films to the Brave and Bold cartoon, it's pretty far and wide. And
yeah, I guess
Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse is very different than
That's true.
Marvel Spider-Man, who's pretty different than like the previous ones. I would say that Garfield and Tom, the Sam Raimi and Andrew Garfield movies are sort of similar, but
Tom Holland,
not in quality.
Tobey Maguire
and Garfield, like.
Your basic conceit of Peter Parker is pretty similar in those. Okay, but like, it's okay. I think it's just like visual design and a name. Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, I agree. The name is really compelling and interesting. And the look, it works. Almost any story you throw on it.
Yeah, I mean, as long as they're still Teenage Mutant Ninja and a Turtles.
That's right.
Here's an email from Patrick. Hello, Milksops, with a shout out to Brian Milksop. First, I wanted to say thanks for turning me on to Marvel by the Month. Oh, good. We gave them one.
Yeah, right. That's
nice.
Like 10 to 1.
I've been catching up on their episodes, and it's great. I'm going to send them a bill for Patrick's listening.
Okay, well, we'll owe them if we start that practice.
I refuse to pay. I'm just going to demand that they pay us.
Okay.
Regarding Zot, it was something I heard about a lot in Wizard Magazine when I was younger, but didn't actually dive into until a few years ago. I bought the compendium and read it over 3 days and loved it. Fast forward to your most recent season, and I learned that there are 10 color issues I didn't know existed. I never realized the compendium started at issue 11. I'm currently taking out a loan from my bank to get the first 10 issues so I can get the full story. Hope the good work. I don't think it's going to cost you that much, but
it better be a fun bank.
I'm glad to hear that those issues hold up without reading the first 10. It feels like they would, but it's hard to say since we read the first 10. Let's see. We got one from Dean. Dean's written us a few times. Hello, Willie and Kev. So casual with us.
You're very familiar.
I hope you're well. I've just reread up to Fantastic Four 243, and Byrne's progressiveness isn't what I remembered it to be. Maybe it was for the time. I was born in 1992, so I'm not completely aware. But when I first read the series, I thought it was far in advance of the Kirby Lee era. It definitely is a step or two in the right direction and does progress further with the explicit name change. So far, though, Reed continues to boss Sue around unnecessarily, and more so than he does Ben and Johnny, due to his love and care of Sue, possibly, but it does stand out as she is the only woman. Typically, these commands are to stay back or not enter a dangerous situation. Sue does argue back and often does as she thinks best. But there are times when Byrne writes for Sue not to enter the fray and passively be part of the climax. Sue's powers definitely allow for her to be a less active combatant. But I don't think it's really until Wade and Wieringo that Sue was able to be used aggressively, for lack of a better term. In that run, I remember being frightened of her powers. DeFalco and Claremont also use Sue well, but I think that Wade is the high watermark. If you haven't read them or the Hickman runs, do yourself a favor and have a read. Love you, Dean.
Rebuttal? Thanks, Dean. Well, I haven't read the Wade one, so it's certainly possible that they go a lot further, Wade or Hickman, and in comparison. I mean, I guess it's just, who's to say, right? He's admitting there's progress and just thinking it's not as much as it used to feel. I think it's a lot. Like, I think it's true. I hadn't noticed. Reed maybe does bark orders, but that could be seen as just Reed being more protective of her. And she does push back and join in the action. So the net result is still a lot of Sue Richards in the mix. It feels very, very different for me. I mean, especially if you're comparing it to Lee Kirby. Like, so I don't know. If you're saying progressiveness is how much agency the Invisible Girl has, I think John Byrne's doing really good, way better than anybody had done until then, making a concerted effort to change things there. And I think he does it. So I don't know. I guess I disagree.
Yeah. I mean, he's talking about 243, which is the one where they fight Galactus. It's pretty early in Byrne's run, right? That's only like,
he started 232. So that's like 11 issues in. It's
maybe a year in. I think there's some small progress. I think it grows more and more. I mean, we just covered a couple of issues where like she was kind of holding her own against Tarax or Tyrius or whatever he was calling himself then. And she started being declared the leader. And I feel like she's pretty proactive in the negative zone arc, too.
Yeah.
I don't recall her like being held back. And I think is that Galactus issue before or after The Child Within?
Childhood's End is before.
Okay. I mean, that issue, she's super powerful.
And she's the star.
Even though she's sort of running from him the whole time. Like,
but it's like sensibly, right? Like,
yeah,
it's shown to be like smart and savvy.
Yeah. I mean, Sue doesn't jump into fight as quickly as the Thing and the Human Torch.
That's probably good, I think.
It's a very good decision on her part. But I mean, when we saw her like just take down a Doombot instantly. Yeah, I have read the Wade run and I haven't reread it since it came out. So I can't remember distinct moments. I for sure remember her being further along, but I think they're building on what Byrne did. And I think they would have done it anyway, just because as a society, we're better about that stuff than we used to be. I mean, that has just, I think it's been a steady progression. I bet also if you read like the Marv Wolfman era, maybe not, but like it would have been a little better than the Kirby era.
Right.
I just sort of expect each era to do a little bit better with
better than what's done before. And it also does matter what society around it is like, you know, yeah. What is comic books, TV and movies like in 1982?
I mean, the Wasp was pretty terribly written in those early Avengers issues. She mostly just like mooned over the Thor, but like she becomes leader of the Avengers before this era. So like, you know, that stuff was progressing.
Yeah, that's true. So I guess we disagree, but we might not be appreciating how much better the next era is because I haven't read it. So that might be true.
I mean, we're disagreeing, but agreeing on every point. Like, it just, I think it's a bigger difference for the 80s than I think.
Yeah.
The Dean can maybe appreciate.
The main way I measure it is when they are, when Reed is missing. And like you say, when Terax is attacking, they say to Sue, you're pregnant. Shouldn't you be, you know, not doing this battle? And she's like, no, my husband is missing. I am the leader of the Fantastic Four. I am part of this. Mm-hmm. And it's not even that big a deal. It's like a single panel.
Yeah.
But that very directly shows the difference between when she was pregnant in the Lee Kirby era, when she basically did nothing. And it's, I also, now that we've read the first 100 issues of Claremont's X-Men run, it's something that Claremont and Byrne were both doing. Like, okay, yes, maybe it's not as female forward as some might like, but they are making a concerted effort to at least bring parity between the genders. Like,
yeah,
being a female character no longer means you are in the back seat. In fact, it means you are just as likely to be the leader. You're just as likely to be the center of the story. You're just as likely to have interesting, tragic flaws that make you an interesting person.
Yeah.
So, you know, with Storm and Kitty Pryde and Phoenix and Rogue over in X-Men, and then the Invisible Girl / Woman over here, Claremont and Byrne are, I think, kind of single-handedly modernizing at least that aspect of Marvel Comics.
Yeah. And definitely like Roger Stern bringing Captain Marvel, Monica Rambeau, and is like a super powerful leader of the Avengers, and like modernizing the Wasp. I mean, it's happening in all the books in a really good way, I think. And some characters, I think, needed it more than others. And the Invisible Woman needed it more than most.
Yeah, because she's part of the flagship title. I mean, she's part of the first family of Marvel Comics. And so any way that she is weak is like setting the example story-wise. Yeah,
exactly. I mean, it's great how powerful she's become. And it's great that it doesn't feel like that will go away now. But I think these were huge necessary steps. It certainly, I remember we read like the first 6 issues of FF in the Digest. Then we read like this run and maybe a few random reprints of other FF issues. But then we got those Essentials. And I remember as a kid reading those and being like, Sue doesn't do anything.
Yeah.
And I think, would have I thought that as a child if I hadn't read the Byrne issues where she seemed cool? Maybe, but it probably wouldn't have hit me as hard.
I mean, I don't think. John Byrne was way more creative in the use of her powers also than Kirby was. Kirby seemed way more concerned with how to use the Human Torch.
Yeah.
I don't know. Interesting point, though. Thank you. We disagree with you, but we like you.
Tony emails us, Tony Labra. emails where he asks us to bring in the third Hines brother. He reminds us that he once asked us to have the third Hines brother on. And so he's happy that we've done that.
Is he the guy who said we should do Squadron Supreme?
I don't keep track.
Yeah, okay. We'll never
those
know.
Those things.
We'll never know.
There's no way for me. I don't want to search my emails. Tony's written us a bunch. I'm not going through them, Tony. So if you were the one who suggested Squadron Supreme, email him to take credit for that too, dude. He adds, just listen to the latest Zot podcast, and what a pleasure it's been listening to Brian. I'm so glad you took my suggestion to heart, even though it took a year. That's pretty quick for us, to be fair.
Yeah.
And it looks like there was never any bad blood that prevented this from happening. I imagine it just came down to scheduling. Anyhow, the camaraderie and banter, sorry, my mouse is covering up a letter, and banter has been really fun. And even though I've never read Zot, as usual, you're making me think about hunting down some issues on eBay or my local comic book shop to check it out. Now I'm really looking forward to the spider talk with the three Hines milksops. Speaking of milksops, and he sent me a screenshot from a Captain America issue. I think this is pre-Grunewald, in case Chris Gethard is listening. And it shows Captain America fighting somebody. And there's some villain lurking in the background who says, I've had enough of this. Those clowns said they were big, bad supervillains, the kind I need for my lieutenants. But they're milksops compared to those crime fighters. That was a little milksop reference.
Nice. Good to know. It's
maybe Porcupine Man. I'm not quite sure who he's fighting. It looks like Porcupine Man. So thank you for that email, Tony. I love milksop references. Zach Hedling sent an email of somebody with a screenshot from Batman Year One from Reddit, I guess. And the person says, I can't read the font in these old comics. And it shows a screenshot of Batman Year One. And it's like the script that Bruce Wayne uses.
Okay.
And he says, I thought you guys would get a kick out of this. And I guess, is it just because people can't read cursive anymore? Do you see?
Yep.
Lee, it's pretty legible. I've definitely seen some writing that's harder to read than this. It's just cursive, I think, is the problem.
I just have no trouble reading it. Yeah, I don't know if...
I don't think people use cursive anymore.
Oh, yeah, that's interesting. I hadn't thought about it.
People just print and type.
That's so wild.
It's funny to have someone reading Batman Year One and not liking it for any reason, honestly.
I hadn't even thought of that, though. If you haven't read a lot of cursive, it could be the letters are drawn differently than they are in any other typeface.
I've definitely read some comics where captions are written as if they're supposed to be handwriting, and they're like just a little too much, and it's hard to read. I don't think that's the case for Batman Year One, but I definitely have read that in some comics where I'm just like, hey, you took it a little too far. I appreciate the effort, but don't. I mean, I don't know. I have no problem reading any of it, I guess.
Yeah, it looks very clear to me, but I hadn't thought about it. That's crazy.
Anyway, who reads the words?
Striking.
Just look at the pictures.
You don't need the words.
Kevin emails us, review Fantastic Four Annual 17 now. It says, Millsaps, hello. I've noticed a hole in your Cosmic Rays and Correspondence series, and I feel it was a major one. The Skrull-connected story from Fantastic Four Annual 17, written and drawn by John Byrne, it was one of my favorite moments from the Byrne era and a very funny callback to one of the silliest moments of the classic Lee Kirby stories. I hope you've read it already, but if not, you're in for a treat. Also, I've enjoyed your podcast quite a lot and enjoyed your guest shot from Brian, who I got to play with when he was improvising in Hartford. Shout out to Brian. Anyway, remember not to go crazy on the Skrull milk and make mine milksop, Kevin. We skip it. I feel like we mostly skip the annuals because Unlimited doesn't link to them when we're just kind of going to the next few
issues. I just forget about them.
Yeah.
We're just lazy. We could maybe do it. And we definitely read it when it came out.
We did it. We read them for the X-Men, but I was always having to check to see if they were showing up, and they were kind of always a drag. So I just wasn't thinking about Fantastic Four because they weren't that good for the X-Men generally.
Yeah.
At least the ones we read.
Yeah.
So, I mean, we should. But I don't know if we will. We're reading enough, right? I mean,
we're reading a lot. Yeah, it's a good idea. We'll think about it. How's that?
That's a good answer. I don't remember that issue, though, specifically. Do you, Will?
Yes, I do.
Okay.
The Skrull milk is a hint.
Yeah, I mean, I can guess what it's about just based on even just that it's connected to that first Skrull story. I think Grant Morrison wrote a Skrull story where people ate Skrull meat from those cows and gained Skrull powers, and it was called Skrull Kill Crew. I never read it, so I think that's what it's about.
Yeah.
The title was definitely Skrull Kill Crew, but it was just an early comic by those guys. Here's an email from Dan.
Okay.
I really enjoyed the recent episodes featuring Zot. I was motivated to dig through my back issues and reread the series. Gotta love those dreeps. And also find my official Zot watch. I was dismayed to find out that I'd forgotten that the watch band is missing. I don't know how to put a new one on and would appreciate a tutorial on your next episode so I can start wearing this neat fashion accessory. I have jury duty coming up soon, and I'm pretty sure that this would help my chances on getting seated on a really juicy case. Thanks in advance. Also, I really enjoyed hearing Brian on the show, and I'm hoping that he becomes a regular. I'd be excited to hear his thoughts on Grunewald's cap run when you tackle it.
Oh, boy.
So we'll see if Brian can sit in for those 12 years of cap issues. Will, next episode, can you prepare a watch band replacement tutorial?
I'll do what I can.
Right.
Have we talked about this? I'm just looking up the Fantastic Four annuals. Do you know who? So Fantastic Four 17 is the one that is the John Byrne annual. I think it's the first annual he did. Do you know who did Fantastic Four annual number 16?
No.
Guess what artist? I'll give you a hint. He created Spider-Man.
All right. Well, Steve Ditko created every character, so I'm going to guess that's Steve Ditko.
That's correct. So Ed Hannigan wrote it, and Steve Ditko penciled and inked it, FF16. I just looked through it in 10 seconds, and it looks okay.
You know, Steve Ditko does not draw a good thing, in my opinion.
Hot take.
Steve Ditko, or Ed Hannigan, rather, drew an issue of Peter Parker, the Spectacular Spider-Man that I read a while back. Mm-hmm. It just looked like he was really trying to channel Steve Ditko throughout the issue. Mm-hmm. He did a really good job.
Oh, wow. Cool.
That's all. I mean, it was clearly not Steve Ditko, but it was like so close that I was like, I'd be into reading a run by this guy drawn this way.
And interesting. I like your opinions. This is from a guy who actually reads comics. Thank you, Kevin.
Paul sends us an email. Zot is good.
Okay.
Hi, Milksops. Just a quick note to say I'd never read Zot before, but your first episode of the season convinced me to buy the black and white collection, and I loved it. And your episodes too.
Oh, that's great. That's great to hear. Thank you for trying it.
Yeah, I'm glad. It seems like everyone who hadn't read it and has tried it has really enjoyed it. So that's good to know.
Makes me feel good because we obviously love that comic.
Mm-hmm. We have a couple more here, Will.
Okay.
This is Scott Rogers, who's emailed us a few times. He's done some comics of his own about a character named Bedbug.
Nice.
Longtime listener, once in a blue moon emailer here. Rather than suggesting you cover the greatest Batman run in comics, Detective Comics 469 to 476, or the second greatest Batman run, Detective Comics 569 to 575, like I've done in the past, instead, I'm going to join the throng of listeners who are demanding that you cover John Byrne's third best series, Alpha Flight 1 through 28, for your mailbag episodes. Not only are they fantastic comics that will teach you all about the provinces of Canada, but you can use the segment title Alpha Mail. It's a win-win Winnipeg.
Interesting title. That's kind of fun.
Alpha Flight feels like the New Warriors of the 80s. Like the fandom of it is outsizes
its success.
Yeah. And the people who love it just really, really love it.
I mean, if you love John Byrne, Alpha Flight is some peak John Byrne. It's really good.
I don't think I read much. I only read a couple issues of it. I don't think it grabbed me as a kid, even though I was loving Fantastic Four. I don't know why.
I don't know why either.
Never gone back to read it. One last email, Will.
Okay.
This is from Owen. And it starts, Hi, Kevin and Will. Love the show. I've been slowly working my way through some of the older episodes and recently listened to the second Chris Gethard episode. Towards the end, you guys have a conversation about superhero characters being written with more depth starting in the 1980s, citing how influential stuff like Watchmen and Squadron Supreme was. If you have never read it, I have a recommendation you would love. Have you guys read Miracle Man or Marvel Man in the UK by Alan Moore? It was the very first dark, non-traditional superhero story and a highly influential Alan Moore story. He wrote it before Watchmen, originally serialized in the British anthology Warriors, along with V for Vendetta. There's an absolutely fascinating behind-the-scenes story involving Captain Marvel, Shazam, multiple legal battles, Fawcett Publishing being sued out of the comics business, Todd McFarlane being sued by Neil Gaiman, and more. Marvel acquired the rights in 2013 and recently released an omnibus with remastered art from the original artists, which is currently the best way to read it. Neil Gaiman is currently continuing the Miracle Man story with a monthly series, Miracle Man: The Silver Age. Unfortunately, it's not available in the Marvel Unlimited app, but if you don't want to buy the Marvel omnibus, it is easy to find digital scans of the original Eclipse comics online. I know you guys get a billion recommendations, and for all I know, you've already mentioned it in another episode that I haven't made it to yet, but I just had to write in with this one after that hearing that episode. Thanks for reading my crazy rambling and the hours of free entertainment. And yes, I think we did talk a little bit about this. We haven't covered it, but we talked a bit about it.
Yeah, we haven't covered it. We've talked about it a couple times. We have read Miracle Man. We've read the Alan Moore part, and I read the initial release of the Neil Gaiman stuff, which, Kevin, you're right, is called The Golden Age. I wasn't sure about that when we talked about this last time, but you're correct.
Thank you. Thank you.
And they re-released Golden Age, including redoing some of the art, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But the story's the same. Those stories were originally done in the 80s, the Neil Gaiman, mm-hmm. What's the artist guy, the Fables guy?
Mark Buckingham.
And now they're doing the Silver Age. So we have read Miracle Man. Kevin, you like it, right?
Yeah.
I like it. It is a really challenging and fun read that is mind-blowing. It goes farther than almost any superhero story has ever gone in terms of what would the weird consequences be of this hero's power. It goes very far. There's lots of, like, something you knew before was actually a conspiracy to a complicated degree. There's weird spiritual stuff, weird science stuff, incredibly gory, violent sequences. There's mm-hmm. trippy stuff involving the gods.
Mm-hmm.
There's lots of sex stuff and love stuff. I mean, it is really an ambitious. It is a comic that's just like, what if I just assume that the readers would follow me anywhere? And it goes there. I love it. It is not for everybody, I think. But there's no doubt about it. That is a masterfully done, ambitious, incredible comic book.
Yeah. And I think we've talked about how, as good as it is, it's almost more impressive what Neil Gaiman does, where he takes this sort of story that ends in a place that feels like you can't go any further, and he explores it.
He does a good job exploring it. Yeah, you're right. It's just, how can you follow up the last issue of Alan Moore's Miracle Man? It's so been heightened to such a crazy place where Miracle Man is basically a god running Earth.
Yeah.
A benevolent god running Earth, and Neil Gaiman does it. And the stories are really good.
They're
and then
really
I started
good, yeah.
to read The Silver Age.
Which there's only two issues out at the time we read these originally.
Yeah, I think I've read three of them now.
Mm-hmm.
And also seems good, and it's going to places I never would have guessed. Like, it is a really, on my initial quick read, it looks like a very worthy successor to Miracle Man.
Yeah, I've read the two, and the new Silver Age issues are completely redrawn by Mark Buckingham, not just touched up.
Golden Age issues.
The Silver Age issues are completely redrawn.
Okay.
The Golden Age was the first arc, uh-huh. and now he's doing the Silver Age. So he did the Golden Age, and he completed it.
In the old days.
Yes.
In the 80s.
Then they started the Silver Age, did not complete it.
Okay. Okay.
Now he is continuing the Silver Age.
I see. I misunderstood.
There's three or four issues of that out. I don't know how many. But the first two issues had already been done, and they've completely redrawn them because Mark Buckingham was like, when these all get collected, I want them to kind of like work together. I don't want it to be like two issues I drew 20 years ago and then how I draw now. So he redrew the first two issues. Like with a lot of the same layouts, but just completely redrawn.
It's one of those stories that's so complicated that I even have trouble remembering a lot of it. Like when I go back and read summaries of it, I'm like, oh yeah, that happened.
And the Miracle Man now is like about young or kid Miracle Man, the one who's not really in any of the stories.
Right.
So this is
okay.
like the realist, the Silver Age. This is the first issue of the new Silver
that.
Age Miracle Man. That's been completely redrawn. And I think in the back, maybe they show a couple of the pages. How they used to look and how they look now, maybe.
Okay,
I don't remember. But I torrented the original Miracle Man like 10, 12 years ago because it was no collection of it. You couldn't afford the back issues. There was no other way to read it. And everyone talked about how it was like so many lists would be like, this is the best comic ever done. I'm like, I can't even read this damn thing.
Yeah.
So I torrented it, which I don't recommend doing. Pay for your comics. But I did that so I could read it, and I loved it. And now that it's kind of re-releasing, I'm sort of waiting for it all to be out.
Yeah.
But I read the first two issues just because I wanted to see the new art. And it's really fun to compare it to the old art.
It's a really special book, for sure. It's a pretty fair representation of the weird, trippy ambition that Alan Moore brings to his stories. And it's disturbing in a lot of times. And
just and Mark Buckingham is just an amazing artist. And I think he's probably right to redraw it. It always feels weird to like, does that mean those first two issues will never be collected? It's sort of a bummer, but also like, he's kind of right. Like, I think the Golden Age ones were collected with his original art. Maybe some tweaks, I don't know, but mostly his original art. So it's like most of his original stuff is in there.
Okay, yeah.
I don't know if they're going to do the Bronze Age is the question. When they finish the Silver Age, will they come back and do like make it a trilogy and do the Bronze Age is sort of a question that everyone assumes. I don't know if he's ever come out and said that this feels like it was meant to be like a three book arc.
Well, I got to read the Silver Age, and I should reread the Golden Age for that matter.
Yeah, I reread the Golden Age a while back, right before the Silver Age came out. I reread all of Miracle Man after some point when we talked about it, and it was really, really good. And I had the same sort of reaction where, like, it starts really good, I kind of lose some interest, it ends really good, and then Neil Gaiman, I think, is even better.
Neil Gaiman's are nicely simpler. It's, like, easier to read those Neil Gaiman stories.
There's less rape in them, too.
Yeah, that's always going to be true when you move away from Alan Moore stories.
Yeah. But, yeah, I mean, we could cover those someday. I don't know if we will. We've covered a lot of Alan Moore stuff.
We're probably more likely to do the rest of Watchmen, unfortunately, if we were going to do more. Or League of Extraordinary Gentlemen.
League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. That's another one we've talked about a lot.
Yeah. That's a more fun read, I think, even though it's not as influential probably as Miracle Man. It's probably not as ambitious. But I just think League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, Volume 1, that's easier just to pick up and read.
Yeah. It's crazy. It's dense, but fun.
Yeah.
This is a long one, Will.
I like it.
Okay.
So
let's get Scott Aukerman to edit this down to 8 pages.
Okay.
That's what we call a comedy callback.
He's a pro. He's a pro, this kind of comedian. All right. So next episode, we are maybe taking a break from Cosmic Rays.
Yes. I think we're going to do a mini episode with our brother next week.
Yeah. A little follow-up he wanted to do about Zot that we didn't have time to do. And then we're going to do another, we'll announce it on Instagram, but we're taking a break from John Byrne for a couple weeks, and then we're going to do Catwoman by
Ed
Brubaker.
Yes, we mentioned that last episode. That is still true. It just won't start next week.
We need time to read them all, we realize. So we're doing a couple episodes while we actually read these comics, so we can actually be like 10% prepared instead of 1% prepared.
That's right.
Okay, guys. Well, thanks for listening, and we'll see you next episode.
Bye, everyone.
Bye. Screw it,
we're just going to talk about comics.